Earn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. And yes, we are worldwide on the internet. So whether you're listening to us on the air here in the tri-state area or online in some far-off place, welcome. Nice to have you with us today. We have a number of guests. A little bit later, we're going to be talking today with David Pinsky, who is with the Greenpeace, that's the environmental group, and he is the co-author of a new report from Greenpeace on plastics, single-use plastics, and the pollution crisis that that is creating, not just here in this country, but all over the world. So we'll talk with him a little bit later on the program, and then what about our future with robots? There's so much about artificial intelligence and robots these days. How are humans going to interact in another decade or two? We'll discuss that with Adam Waits later on the program today. But first, we are delighted on the first portion of the program to be able to talk with a local writer. Her name is Julie Tulba, and she's with us right here in the studio. Julie, it's nice to see you again.
The same, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
We talked earlier. You're with the Butler Area Public Library. You're
yes.
on the staff there, and you were with us to for one of our book talk. I think it was, what, a year or so ago? I don't remember exactly when.
Back at the end of August, I think.
Yeah. It was a good, it was The Last Envoy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a good book.
Never go wrong with historical nonfiction.
Well, lo and behold, you've turned out your first novel, just published, entitled The Tears of Yesteryear. That's just published this year, right?
Yes, back in May, last month. I'm losing track of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a novel, a coming-of-age novel,
yes.
About a young woman who is orphaned, and she comes to America from Poland.
Yes, that's correct.
What's the name of that main character?
So the main character's name is Ava, but it's spelled the Polish way, which is E-W-A. I have had a couple people already ask me how to pronounce it. It's still pronounced Ava, like with a V. It's just the Polish way of spelling Ava is E-W-A.
Same thing happens in German, by the way,
yes.
where a W is pronounced mm-hmm. like a V. Wagner. Volkswagen, that sort of thing. Ava, what's Ava's last name?
Piekos. So the Tears of Yesteryear is loosely based on my own great-grandmother. Back in the day when immigrants would come through Ellis Island, the native surnames were always butchered in terms of just handwriting them wrong, not being able to understand the people. So the files that I found on my great-grandmother, her name has been spelled many different variations. Piekos was one of them, so I kind of loosely based the Ava of the Tears of Yesteryear on my own paternal great-grandmother, Ava.
I know about those changes. Mullarkey is the same way. It's a little bit different in this country than it is in the old country of Ireland. So this is loosely based, then, on your...
Yes.
Great.
My own paternal great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. My paternal grandfather, his mother and dad, came to America. I think she came in 1912. He came in 1913. They didn't know each other at the time. They ended up meeting in Pennsylvania on the eastern side of the state. But I don't know many details about her except the age that when she came over to America, the ship that she came over on, where she departed from in Europe, just the little tidbits that I wish I could delve deeper into. But that's most of what I have.
Again, the title of Julie's novel is The Tears of Yesteryear. And it opens actually in Pittsburgh, which
yes.
is where Ava ends up after emigrating, in Pittsburgh in 1944. And Ava, unfortunately, is terminally ill at
yes.
that point.
She was given a diagnosis of not too much time left to live, which is really just troubling and hard for her as all of her sons are overseas fighting in the war that had already been going on for a couple years, World War II, of course.
Yeah, 1944, World War II. And then it flashes back
yes.
From that brief prologue We go all the way back to 1902 on board the immigrant ship SS Finland.
Yes. And that was actually the ship that my own great-grandmother traveled to America on. It was an ocean liner that did a lot of transatlantic voyages from Antwerp, Belgium, over to New York Harbor, I should say. But yeah.
So Antwerp was a common point of departure for European immigrants?
Yes. I know Antwerp and Hamburg were, I want to say my own paternal great-grandfather left from Hamburg, but my Ava and then the Ava of the story, they left from Antwerp.
We want to set up the story. Obviously, people who are interested will want to read your novel. You know, we don't want to spill all the beans, but we can kind of set the stage. 1902, how did Ava end up coming to the United States, becoming an immigrant? It was due to an uncle, right?
Right. So her uncle was kind of the guardian, loose guardian of Ava and her sister, Manya. This isn't giving anything away. Manya ends up dying on the voyage to America, so it's basically just Ava and her uncle, Joseph. When she gets to America, she kind of finds out the reason what brought Ava and what should have been her sister, Manya, to America as well. It was kind of a lot of deception on the part of Ava's uncle, but Ava had to leave behind her grandmother, and the term for grandmother in Polish is babcia. But basically, that was all of the family that Ava had left, was just her sister, her uncle, and her grandmother, who she never would get to see again. But she travels to America just with her uncle. Her mom and dad have long been deceased.
I can only imagine when your sister, with whom you're very close, dies on an immigrant ship. Now, I'm not that familiar with the Polish immigration. I am pretty well read on Irish immigration, which is the land of my ancestors, and I know that the immigrant ships from Ireland to the United States were horrible conditions. Just horrendous. And there were a lot of people who died on the voyage.
From the research that I did, it seemed from like the 1910s on, conditions for immigrants traveling in the steerage class, they had improved somewhat. But I wanted to set my book at the turn of the last century, when they were still pretty dire for the immigrants traveling over in terms of just the food rations that they were given, sleeping conditions. It was still a very horrific, stark experience, especially to travel over waters as rough as the Atlantic Ocean. Ava ends up traveling in end of March, April, so obviously the Northern Atlantic would have still been pretty choppy, not so smooth sailing at that time.
Well, you create very vividly in our mind's eye, as we read your novel, the conditions on the ship. First of all, when her older sister died, she has to watch her being buried at sea. And the priest does the burial rites in Latin because he doesn't know Polish. So, again, very disconcerting as it is to have your sister dead, not to be able to hear the funeral rites in your own language. What this must do to a teenager, Ava is 15 or something like that at this time. Wow. And so she comes to America, you know, the SS Finland finally rolls in. You put the great emphasis on looking at the Statue of Liberty as the ship comes into New York Harbor.
I know it's cheesy, but I still remember that ending scene in the Titanic film from 1997 with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. But just when Kate Winslet comes into New York Harbor and just sees the towering hulk of Lady Liberty before her, that was just something I had envisioned with Ava as well. You know, she had survived this horrific voyage. She had survived, literally seeing the death of her sister. But now she came to this new land, and that's the first image that greeted her and millions of other immigrants.
Bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. We had to memorize that poem when I was in high school, and it's always stuck with me. It's a beautiful thought.
It is, definitely.
Yeah. So, again, we're just setting the stage here for the bulk of the novel, The Tears of Yesteryear, but Ava finally does arrive in New York with her uncle Joseph is on the ship too, by the way, even though her older sister has died en route. But then, shockingly, Ava finds out that she is, quote, promised already.
So basically, Joseph didn't really have much of an opportunity to do work back in Poland, as was the case for so many immigrants why they came to America. There was little work for farmers, for laborers, and stuff like that. So he wouldn't have had the money to pay for his passage, let alone the passage of his two nieces. So what was often the custom at that time was someone who was already settled, an immigrant who was settled in the States, that they would agree to pay for the passage over of a young woman so that they would then become their bride. Originally, it was supposed to be Manya, the older sister, the sister who had more of the family duty to fulfill. She was supposed to have been the intended for the widower already in America, but with Manya having died, Ava had to assume that role, which was complete news and a shocker to her at only 15.
How did their uncle ever get the idea to emigrate to America to begin with?
There were other people in the village that had previously immigrated, and they were corresponding letters back between America and Sherwona Wola, the name of the village, you know, and kind of just putting all these grandiose thoughts and illusions into Joseph's head that, you know, you can get rich really fast, you'll have money, you won't, you know, be in a tiny little house anymore, just everything would change for the better.
And how is it that Ava eventually ended up in, well, we say Pittsburgh, we're actually in Homestead?
That was basically where the family that Uncle Joseph had known back in Pittsburgh, that was where they ultimately settled. And the family, the local family in Homestead, they then knew of this widower who was looking for a bride, you know, basically someone to take care of his little child to assume the duties of, you know, keeping house and home.
So he would have been much older than Ava?
Yes, and that was often the custom that you had these young immigrant girls who were, you know, barely into their teens, and they were marrying men at least a decade older, sometimes a lot more.
Your novel is divided into five parts, right?
Yes.
Different stages of Ava's life?
Exactly, yeah. So you have the part of her, you know, in the waning days of the voyage to America, and then the Ellis Island section, which was so... So much of a, I can't think of the word I want to say, just a change for people to go through to realize, you know, your life could be said yay or nay simply from going through an examination at Ellis Island, to Homestead when she initially marries Andres to, well, I don't want to give too much away, but yes, five stages of Ava's life in the New World.
How did you get details on exactly what immigrants went through at Ellis Island? Did you have to do some research on that?
I did. I ended up going to the Heinz History Center. They have a really good library. And then also just give a shout out, being a librarian myself, to local public libraries. Just a lot of local, or a lot of good books in terms of just Pittsburgh historical background and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the date that Ellis Island opened, but it would have been pretty close to the same time that you're novel,
yes,
begins in 1902.
So they had a wooden structure for a couple of decades, but then that ended up building down. So the structure we see today that we can visit as tourists, I want to say 1890s, that's when it would have opened,
mm-hmm,
roughly.
And by the way, it's no longer an immigration center. That closed down, mm-hmm, many, many years ago.
Right.
But it's now a museum.
Yes. I visited once when I was 13 with my dad. So needless to say, as an older, wiser person, I would love to go back and just, you know, see it again, especially after having written The Tears of Yesteryear and just imagining Ava and all the other immigrants passing through its doors.
We'll take a break. We're chatting with Julie Tolba, author of The Tears of Yesteryear. She's a local writer. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. If you're wrapping up your spring cleaning, as I am, I started early this year, but it kind of bogged it down. Listen, if you come up with items that you don't need or don't want anymore, don't just automatically toss them in the trash, because that goes into the landfill, and we don't need any more in the landfill than we can get away with, right? Consider donating unwanted items to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store. It's in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South, very easy to get to. Tons of free parking right outside the door. Their drop-off bins are right inside the front door. Yeah. Clothing, furniture, knickknacks, many, many items. They sell those at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store, and every penny of the proceeds from the operation of the store helps to fund their food bank and their client aid program. So think about it. And remember, too, they're running their produce collections again this summer. Starting in a few weeks, they'll have details about the collection if you'd like to donate some of the excess produce from your backyard garden to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. They'd love to have it. Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler, they like to say, we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Back to talk more with Julie here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Michael's Restaurant is now open for breakfast at 7 a.m. Join us for breakfast any day of the week, including after church on Sundays. Have you made plans for dinner yet? Bring the family for a great home-cooked meal. Michael's Restaurant also offers great Sunday dinner specials, stuffed chicken breasts, stuffed pork chops, lasagna, and more.
Thinking about remodeling or refinancing your home? ARMCO Credit Union's new HELOC combines the flexibility of a traditional home equity line of credit with the low fixed rate of a home equity loan. Lock in different amounts, rates, and terms up to 20 years under one convenient loan agreement and monthly payment without the hassle of reapplying as your borrowing needs change. It's never been easier to join. So call or visit us at one of our locations or online at armcocu.com to become a member. ARMCO Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome back. Boy, it's nice to be chatting with Julie Tolba today. She's on staff at the Butler Area Public Library, and she has become a writer herself. Actually, you did some writing before this, right?
Yes.
You had short stories or something like that?
I did. In 2014, I published a collection of short stories entitled Full Circle, Tales of Travel and Self-Discovery from Around the World. It was when I was in college that I kind of started to really love the short story prose, just because I had always hated it before. I just found they were lacking. You know, I wanted more of the story to read. But then I was introduced to an Indian-American author called Jhumpa Lahiri, who writes nothing but short stories just about, and I was hooked, and that's what gave me the idea to write my own stories. And I also have a travel and food blog, The Redheaded Traveler, as I do have red hair. So,
I am not a writer, but I've talked to writers who, many of them seem to think it's more difficult to write a good short story than a novel.
That it is, because you still want to do as good of a job in terms of the projection, the delivery, but then you have to wrap it up a lot sooner than maybe you intend. You can't, you know, have too much excess with your words going on, so it can be tricky.
I love your title, The Tears of Yesteryear. It's very evocative. Mm-hmm. Did you have to cipher on that for a while, or was the title with you early on?
I did contemplate the title, I think, probably when I only written about 50 or so pages. I kind of got obsessed with having a title to then, you know, keep basing the rest of the story off of. But then I wanted to have something sad and melancholic, as the story definitely is in that kind of a category. But then I can't remember if it was a book or a movie, but something was referenced with yesteryear in the title, so then that's how I kind of ended up pairing it with tears, so I thought it fit.
There is a lot of sadness in your story. Ava contemplates the people that she's left behind in Poland. She is an orphan. Her
yes.
mother... I'm trying to remember. Her mother died and then her father left.
Is right. So the mother died basically a few days after giving birth to their baby brother, who also ended up passing. Then the father ended up leaving. So it's not ever fully known if the father is actually deceased, but he completely abandoned his, you know, two surviving daughters.
Can you imagine leaving that behind, knowing that you're never going to see it again?
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to see your village or Poland
right.
or anything else. And getting on a ship and sailing across the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost unfathomable, isn't it?
Definitely. Also, just because at that time, the turn of the last century, this was before, you know, computers, smartphones, but even, you know, the average person like Ava and her relatives, they wouldn't have had the money to, you know, go get their formal photographs taken. So it wasn't even a case where they had, you know, a plethora of photos to look through when they were feeling, you know, homesick or things like that.
Their photographs would have to be in their mind's eye.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You used a term that I had never seen before. I think it's the Polish word for grandmother, but I'm not sure.
Yes. Babsha.
Babsha?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, I would never have pronounced it that way. But again, I know no Polish.
I had to find a good Polish dictionary that gave the phonetic pronunciation, because otherwise I've studied Spanish and French, really good with Spanish, Polish, a different beast. So
your novel would be of interest to anyone, actually, but I should think, you know, there's a lot of people of Polish ethnicity here in western Pennsylvania. In fact, there's even a place in Pittsburgh. You didn't know this. You went to school in Pittsburgh. Polish Hill.
Yes. I love driving by the one street because they have the spelling, or the street is named Pauline Street, but it's spelled in the Polish way, Paulona Street. I'm probably mispronouncing that. But I just love going through that area today. I mean, today it's known as the Hill District, but hundreds some years ago it was Polish Hill, where you would have just smelled pierogi and everything else of Polish nature.
You're originally from Philadelphia, yes. Transplanted here to western Pennsylvania. How did that ever happen, Julie?
I ended up going to Chatham for my undergraduate degree, and then I went to Pitt for my master's. I'll say soda till my dying breath. I won't ever say pop. So.
Yes, for those of you who don't have friends or relatives in Philadelphia, they don't say pop. They say soda. Mm-hmm. I say it, too, only because a lot of my fraternity brothers were from Philadelphia, and they said it that way as well. So you like it here in western Pennsylvania, huh?
I do. A few things that I will say Philadelphia is superior to, but I do enjoy, you know, just being in a different part of the state. Even though there's only 5 hours distance between them, the two cities are drastically different, so it's a nice change of pace.
You are a world traveler, yes. Even at your relatively young age. Just before we went on the air today, you mentioned how many countries you've been able to visit, and I just about fell off my chair.
I'm at either 28 or 29. I studied abroad a couple different times in college, so that obviously helped, but ever since then, if I have the time and the means, I'm off traveling, getting my passport stamped, although I was in London a few weeks ago, and at Heathrow, they didn't stamp your passport anymore, so I was a little disappointed. Just all the automated machines, which kind of stinks if you like that thrill of getting a stamp.
Oh, it's so nice to look at, and even when you get a new passport, they send your old one back.
Yes, pour over the pages.
They drill holes in it, but send it back to you. It's great to go back and look at the stamps. And, oh, yeah, that's when I was here. That's when I was there. They don't do that anymore.
Memories. At least not in a major place like London. I'm headed to Turkey at the end of August, so I'm hoping I will at least get a Turkish passport stamp.
So, obviously, if you studied in Europe, because one of your major areas of study was Spanish.
Yes.
So, and if you're in Spain, you know, going to another country is kind of like going to Shakora.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they're pretty close. Have you traveled in other parts of the world other than Europe?
I did. I've been to Argentina, Peru, Uruguay, and South America, and I also studied abroad in South Korea. I want to definitely see Africa, though. I want to get to sub-Saharan Africa, so that's my dream.
My gosh. Europe, South America, Asia? You only have one part of the world left that you haven't been to.
I know. Well, Australia and Antarctica, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to get those in, too.
Yeah, for sure.
And you you blog on this?
I do. So my blog is called The Redheaded Traveler. I've gotten a little rusty just because I've been doing it for 9 years now. I used to be very prolific with posting. I've kind of fallen off a little bit, but I'm trying to get back in the saddle. And I blog about anything just pertaining to my travels, Pittsburgh restaurants, Pittsburgh happenings of a history, cultural nature.
So you travel, you blog, you have a full-time job. When the heck do you ever find time to write?
Sitting on a couch at home, just having good music on, my inspiration. So.
I've talked to some writers who try to, if they're working on a project, they try to set aside X number of hours or minutes each day. You know, get kind of disciplined about it. Are you able to do that, or do you have periods where you're writing furiously and then other times where you kind of slack off a little bit?
I definitely, in writing The Tears of Yesteryear, I would go through periods where I just had so many great ideas going through my head, I would have to jot them down to make sure I didn't forget about them. And then maybe just, you know, go at it for a week strong, but then kind of take a break. But then at other points, I would just say once I got home from work at 4, I need to write for 2 hours, you know, just to make sure I kept going with, you know, making sure the story didn't fall off.
Do you write longhand, or do you use
I type. I did longhand for some blog posts right when I started, and it's just too tedious. So I type everything, and I probably don't back up my stuff like I should have, but thankfully it's published, so I don't have to worry about losing it.
I've talked to a bunch of writers over the years, and some still do prefer to, you know, do the longhand on legal paper. That would drive me nuts.
It would.
I'm not the fastest typist in the world, but it's so easy to go back and correct, you know, whenever you're using the PC. The cover of your book, The Tears of Yesteryear, is haunting. I know that in most cases, authors have nothing to do with that. That's kind of a publisher thing. Is that what happened to you, and are you pleased with the cover?
No, so I got to design and choose the cover. I found that image, and it just was a portrait in the public domain entitled, Young Immigrant Girl. I think the girl actually that I used her image, she's Italian, but she just so evoked what I thought Ava might possibly have looked like at that time. And then the background image that it's transposed on was a street scene in Homestead, PA at the turn of the last century. I was able to publish the publishing rights for it from Pitt, from their archives. I liked how the two kind of intersected. I thought, as you said, very haunting, and that's what a lot of people have told me so far.
Oh, it is. It's a gorgeous cover. And then it's in a kind of a combination sepia and a light blue.
Yes.
Which is also, to me at least, it's very evocative.
I got the inspiration for the colors from the book The Nightingale, which was Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale book. I just liked those, the choice of the colors used, so I thought I should do that myself with my image.
So you've published a collection of short stories, now your first novel, The Tears of Yesteryear. Jolie Tulba, anything else in the pipeline? Do you have anything else that you're free to talk about at this point?
I would love to do another historical fiction novel set in Pittsburgh. I love anything to do with World War I because I feel that's also an area in literature not really well represented, and I'd like to do it with a Pittsburgh focus. So you see all the Doughboy statues all over neighborhoods like Lawrenceville, here in Butler too, Doughboy Park. So that would ideally like to be my next idea.
So are you researching this already, or do you just, I don't know. See, I'm not a writer. When you're out at a restaurant and an idea pops into your head, do you grab a napkin and write it down and stuff it in your pocket, or what?
I haven't gotten to that stage yet. I think maybe let 2019 pan out, but then perhaps a year from now at this time, I'll have my new ideas flowing.
I have a fresh copy of your book signed. Thank you very much for that. Is it available to the general public already?
It is, yes. It's on Amazon's website, so it's available in paperback and then also for Kindle if you are a fan of more of the digital devices to read your books on. It's on Amazon's website.
I'm a fan of having the book in my hand where I can turn the pages.
I am as well.
Myself. Are you going to have a book signing or something anywhere?
Hopefully in September down in the North Hills at a bookstore in McCandless, right on McKnight Road. The bookstore is called Riverstone Books. I'm going to be doing an event there at the end of September, so hopefully we'll be able to see some of you there then.
Yeah, because a lot of people, it's a local writer. They like to see you and say hi. Maybe have you sign a book.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to see you again.
The same. Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
And I must say that I really enjoyed The Tears of Yesteryear.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, for a lot of folks around here, they may not be first-generation immigrants, but parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, and this is a story that will touch a lot of hearts, I think, around here. Whether your family comes from Poland or Eastern Europe or anywhere.
Right. The immigrant tale just transcends so many ethnicities. I mean, mine was of a Polish setting, but the same applies to Italian, German, Slovakian. So.
The Tears of Yesteryear by Jolie Tulba, T-U-L-B-A, if you're looking for her online. Jolie Tulba. Thanks, Jolie.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Have a good day. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
All righty. More to come on It's Your Turn. We'll take a break. We're going to be chatting coming up next with a guy from Greenpeace. That's the environmental group, Greenpeace. His name is David Pinsky. He is the co-author of a new report from Greenpeace on the plastic crisis that is plaguing the world, actually, with the plastic, which takes forever to decompose, if then. And the growing crisis that we have with the single-use plastic items around the world. That's coming up next on It's Your Turn. Stick around. We'll be back right after these words.
$3. Not too much $3 can buy these days. Not even a gallon of gas. Fortunately, with the Butler Transit Authority, $3 provides you with all-day transportation with over 250 local Butler bus stops. Butler Transit can get you to all the major Butler shopping destinations, medical facilities, downtown, and much more. Visit our downtown bus terminal on West Newcastle Street or on the web at butlertransit.com.
At Osterling's Lawn and Garden, there's plenty for you and your pets to be excited about. They have pet fountains from 80 to 125 ounces, along with 25 and 50-pound Van Hess pet food storage containers. Fill those containers with some of their grain-free dog biscuits. And with summer celebrations in full swing, you may want to consider picking up a Comfort Zone calming vest for your dog. It can help with anxiety, thunderstorms, and those summertime fireworks. You can find it all at Osterling's Lawn and Garden in Butler.
Coming up on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. We're chatting via telephone with David Dipinski. A new Greenpeace report entitled Packaging Away the Planet ranks 20 of the largest U.S. grocery retailers for the first time on their efforts to eliminate single-use plastics. And we're pleased to talk with the co-author of that report, David Pinsky. David, nice to have you with us here today.
Thank you so much, Dave. Great to be here.
So what's the problem with plastic? I mean, we see stories about a lot of plastic waste floating in the ocean. Here we are in western Pennsylvania. What do we have to worry about plastic getting into the ocean? We're a long ways from the ocean. What's the deal?
Well, unfortunately, what we're finding with the plastic pollution crisis is it's not just the oceans. Plastics have been found in our air, in our food, in our drinking water, and especially now we're seeing an increase in production of plastics and in facilities that are being built in Appalachia to meet this growing plans that the petrochemical industry has to actually quadruple the production of plastics over the next couple of decades.
And they really are everywhere. I mean, we don't realize, maybe we don't stop to think about it. For example, when I was a kid and went on a picnic, we talked about getting paper plates. The problem today is most of those paper plates aren't paper. They're plastic. And we have plastic cutlery. We have, if you go to your favorite restaurant and you need, a take-home container, it's usually plastic or styrofoam. If you buy drinking straws these days, they're mostly plastic. Again, you don't have to go that far back. Certainly when I was a kid, David, straws were made out of paper.
Exactly. And so, Dave, we are fortunately starting to see some moves away from single-use plastics. So if you look at straws as an example, there are paper straws that are coming out all over the place. But the issue here is that we really need to shift our culture away from single-use any material, plastics, paper, et cetera, into move to more reuse and refill delivery systems. And so that, you know, that's really one of the ways that we're going to tackle this issue. We also need to stop plastic production at the source. And that's why we have evaluated 20 of some of the largest U.S. grocery retailers on their efforts to eliminate single-use plastics, because this is an area where customers, you know, on a daily basis, whether it's in stores or online, are interacting with products, many of them packaged in single-use plastics.
I checked out your report, and there are 20 grocery retailers listed here across the nation. Two of them have outlets here in our area of western Pennsylvania, Giant Eagle and Whole Foods. How do they rank in your report, David Pinsky?
So not so well. I should first note that every single retailer we evaluated received a failing score, so that should indicate to listeners how much work is needed for them to take responsibility for this growing plastic pollution crisis that they're contributing to. Whole Foods might surprise some folks, came in at 11th. Giant Eagle was even lower, ranked 16th.
So let's talk about some of the more common instances of single-use plastics that everyone would be familiar with. The ubiquitous plastic bag at the checkout counter, not just at grocery stores, but at, you know, the discount retailers, Walmart, and so on and so forth. We use billions of these every day. Any alternative to that, and is it possible in the near-term future?
So we're certainly seeing an increase of reusable bags, which is a move in the right direction. Some retailers are switching to paper bags. Giant Eagle, as we note in the report, is starting to do some pilot programs on eliminating single-use plastic checkout bags. The thing I want to underscore here, Dave, is that these are absolutely moves in the right direction, but what we need to see is an increased scale and urgency to look at all single-use plastics in their operations. And ultimately, what we'd love to see whether it's Giant Eagle, Whole Foods, Walmart, to come out with public-facing commitments to ultimately eliminate single-use plastics in their operations, and again, move toward that reuse and refill delivery systems that are not going to require single-use materials in the first place.
Can we offer some sort of a bonus or perhaps a penalty for single-use plastic bags? I know some European countries, Ireland, for example, many, many years ago, went to charging a fee if you want a bag. You know, if you want it, you got to pay for it.
Yes, and that's something that certainly seems to work in many countries, and I think there is that opportunity to incentivize folks, whether it's a fee or whether they, say, get rewards points with that retailer's program, to incentivize that behavior to shift to bringing your reusable bag. Or one thing we'd love to see, and this is happening in Canada with a large grocery retailer in Quebec called Metro, folks are able to bring their own containers into the stores, whether it's to the deli, to the seafood counter, to pick up hot foods, and that way they're able to bring their own container and don't need to rely on any single-use packaging in the stores themselves. So we're hopeful that initiatives like that will be taken up by retailers such as Whole Foods, Giant Eagle, you know, Aldi, Trader Joe's, and others.
Let's talk about Aldi. That's another store, another chain that we have outlets here in Western Pennsylvania. How did Aldi score on your report, David?
So Aldi, again, all of the retailers received failing scores, but Aldi came the closest to a passing score, and that was actually the top-ranked retailer we evaluated. This is for a couple of reasons. Aldi has a public-facing commitment to reduce single-use plastics. Unfortunately, that's only by 15% and not until 2025. So we'd love to see Aldi move to 100%. Aldi was more transparent than many other retailers, and it actually has some plans to implement a pilot program next year for reusable packaging for its own brand products. So these are all steps in the right direction, and we continue to hope and encourage retailers like Aldi to be even more ambitious. And we believe customers are going to really appreciate that in the years to come.
What about other stores? We mentioned Walmart earlier. What about Walmart, Target, Costco, some of those? How are they doing?
So Walmart came in at 6th, Target at 8th, and Costco at 9th. We see especially the size of these three retailers. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world, largest in the United States. Costco by revenue is the third largest. They have a massive opportunity to harness their purchasing power because they're such big companies, and to demand consumer goods companies like Nestle move to more reusable ways of delivering products. So if Walmart, for example, or Costco or Target said to Nestle, we're no longer going to accept your products in our stores unless they are not wrapped in single-use plastics and are delivered in another method, another format, that's going to send a powerful message to Nestle. So we have seen some levels of commitments across each of those three retailers. Unfortunately, it's not going far enough. As an example, Walmart has a goal of 20% recycled content in its own brand products by 2025. That's 5.5 years out. If you look at a comparison from Walmart to Kroger, Kroger has a plastic bag ban that should be implemented by 2025. Silence from Walmart on that issue.
It's amazing when you stop and think about how many things used to be biodegradable, but now aren't. I mentioned paper plates. Something as simple as cotton swabs. They used to all come with a wooden stick. Now most of them are plastic sticks, right?
Yes, and you know that's an interesting point you raise on biodegradable products. So bioplastics are a increasing proposed solution to plastics, conventional plastics made out of fossil fuels. Unfortunately, what we need here, Dave, is for there to be industrial facilities that can properly break down those materials. If a bioplastics get into the oceans, there's not the conditions to break them down. So in essence, they can act very similarly to plastics, threatening marine life, that's not a solution there. So we're certainly mindful of that issue and want to encourage retailers, again, to move away from single-use materials altogether.
And when plastics do eventually degrade, they end up in our seafood and we eat them. That's an unpleasant thought, isn't it?
It is, and I was actually out in, listeners may be familiar with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch there in the Pacific Ocean, and I was out there on board one of our vessels, the Greenpeace's Arctic Sunrise, last year in September and October for a three-week expedition. And one of the things that was stunning was we didn't see that large floating pile of trash that many have been told it exists. It's actually more like a miso soup, where we saw some larger pieces of plastics. I actually retrieved a Coca-Cola bottle with my own hand when I was out there hundreds of miles offshore. But many of the pieces of plastic out there are microplastics. So plastics never go away. We talked earlier about how they're pervasive in our oceans, in our air, in our food, our drinking water. A microplastic is a plastic that has fragmented into a piece that's smaller than 5 millimeters, and then those are eaten by marine life, and as you point to, that's eaten by us as seafood. So this is very much a worldwide public health crisis, and for retailers that are looking to make profits and continue to sell seafood, I would imagine they'd want to make sure that seafood is free of plastics.
There's the elephant in the middle of the room that we haven't really mentioned too much, David Pinsky, and that's plastic bottles, whether it's for water or sugary drinks or whatever. You don't have to go back more than a couple of decades whenever most of that came in glass or cans. Now, we've got these plastic bottles everywhere, billions of them around the world every day, right?
Yes, it's estimated around, and it's probably over 500 billion a year now at this point. So it's pretty overwhelming amount of plastic bottles. And again, water, look, you can get water out of your tap. There are fortunately some initiatives now by large consumer goods companies to look at how they can deliver products such as water without water bottles, plastic water bottles, that is. So I think they're starting to listen, these companies, and that's an encouraging sign. And one of the things that customers and listeners that you can do is we have a interactive rankings website that distills the information from this larger report. It's called Shopping for Plastic. So if you Google Shopping for Plastic, Greenpeace, that'll pull it up. It's mobile friendly and a great way for you to learn a little bit more about these issues, how your favorite grocer ranks, and how you can take action.
Is your full report, Packaging Away the Planet, is that available online as well?
That is also available online. So if you go to that user-friendly interactive ranking, Shopping for Plastic, you can see there will be several links there to download the report. Or you can also Google Packaging Away the Planet. And one thing, Dave, we're encouraging listeners to do is the next time you're at the grocery store, next time you're at Giant Eagle, ask to speak to the manager. Have a two-minute conversation. Let them know why you're concerned about this issue, how you'd like to see Giant Eagle and others take leadership. And that makes a big difference. And I know sometimes folks may be not really interested or have the time to talk to the manager, so you can let your comments be known on social media, or also they have comment boxes in stores, and feel free to drop a note in the box.
A new report from Greenpeace assessing U.S. retailers and the plastic pollution crisis. And we've been able to talk with the co-author of that report, David Pinsky. David, thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Sure. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers is celebrating 25 years of calling Butler home, and they're inviting you to join them for an ice cream social. On Thursday, July 25th at the Tanglewood Center from 5:30 to 7:30, come enjoy a fun few hours with Brewster's Ice Cream, basket raffles, and a chance to visit with the Tri-Rivers physicians and staff. There's no cost to attend, but please RSVP for the event by July 19th by visiting TriRiversMSK.com.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Coming up, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone, award-winning social scientist Adam Waitz, talking about a new book he's written entitled The Power of Human. The Power of Human, Adam Waitz, what's that title mean?
The Power of Human means that human beings are a powerful psychological stimulus. They give meaning to our lives. They make us act in moral ways. They influence us to do amazing things, and they motivate us to work hard. Oftentimes, people work harder on behalf of other humans than even for a paycheck or for themselves.
That's certainly the positive side, but there are negatives too. I mean, humans do have the capacity to dehumanize entire groups of people and treat them in shocking ways. Talk a little bit about that. How do we dehumanize people in today's world?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so this book is sort of a response to what I see as a creeping dehumanization that's entered our lives and that's persisted over the past 4 or 5 decades. So dehumanization comes in all forms. We could think of dehumanization in really stark ways in the context of genocide or the Holocaust or slavery. But there's also everyday dehumanization, which I think has crept into our lives in the U.S., where we're growing apart from each other. You see more people living alone. You see less socializing amongst young people. You see lower reports of people experiencing empathy for each other and trust in each other. And it manifests in things like political polarization, where people from the left and the right no longer see eye to eye on anything. Income inequality, where the lowest and highest social classes are increasingly separated. And then forces like free markets, which simply fundamentally change our behavior toward each other, where everyone is sort of viewed in terms of their fundamental instrumental value, as well as the rise of technology, which mediates all of our interactions and pulls us apart as well.
Well, that's for sure. I want to talk a little bit about the role that you see fake news having as a driver of dehumanization. By the way, before we start on that, I hate that term fake news because it's become more encompassing than it really is. You know, generally speaking, the reputable news organizations, the national news agencies, are still doing fine. Fake news, that's to me, refers to, you know, the stuff you see on social media, and people think that's real news, and it's not. But anyway, that's another story
that's
for another
exactly
day.
Exactly right. You know, fake news has become the stand-in for sort of anything I don't agree with in the news, right? And so true fake news is something that is demonstrably false. And so the peril of social media is that it makes fake news spread extremely quickly. In fact, there was one study that showed that false information circulates more easily than true information on social media. And oftentimes the nature of this fake news is to stir up discord and stir up conflict, which is much easier to do also when you're not in a face-to-face setting, when you don't have to confront people in their full humanity. So I think social media really can pose a problem. On the other hand, social media gives us this unprecedented access to people who are not like us, to people who live in places far away, to people who hold very different opinions. And so if used in the right way, I think it could be used for good.
We mentioned earlier, listeners, that our guest Adam Waitz is an award-winning social psychologist. He's also an associate professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Harvard Business Review, the Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere as well. Awful lot in the news these days, Adam, about artificial intelligence and robots. And although some people might think that's way off down the road, it might not be. Could humans and robots work together at some point in the maybe not too distant future?
That's the hope. And I think, interestingly, we've sort of let robots into our lives without even noticing. So the robots don't look like the metal machines that we might have seen in old sci-fi movies, but they look like Alexa, Amazon's voice-activated assistant, or GPS in our cars, or Siri on the iPhone. So we're constantly interacting with these robots. They're creeping into our lives, and I offer a few ways that I think we can effectively partner with these machines and robots so we don't lose our humanity. One way being that I think we can divide up sort of the moral work. And what I mean by the moral work is people want to make the right decisions. They want to do the right thing. And what robots are pretty good at doing is calculating relative costs and benefits to a decision. But what humans can also do is say, was there any moral rule that was violated? So, for example, a robot is very good at, say, as an algorithm, deciding, you know, what's the best hiring versus firing decision. If you're a manager, you could have an algorithm scan all your employees and say, well, this is going to provide the lowest cost and the highest benefit. But the human can also step in to that analysis and say, well, is this hiring or firing decision doing any discrimination? Okay, so that's where you can have sort of the robot do the heavy lifting or the algorithm, and the human saying, well, is there any moral rule being violated? So that's the type of thing I talk about when I think about collaboration.
Interesting point, and something that I perhaps have been guilty of at times myself when we talk about, when we hear about robots. Depending on how old you are, that's the first thing that pops into your mind. You know, maybe R2-D2 or CP-3-3-0 or whatever that other robot was in Star Wars.
Or Rosie from the Jetsons.
Yes, even better. But robots today are things like Echo and Alexa and that sort of thing. I just saw a news story in the past day or so that Walmart is now going to be employing artificial intelligence cameras on those self-checkout lines to make sure that people aren't trying to sneak through, you know, without scanning something whenever they're checking out themselves.
A lot of my work says, you know, a lot of the technology folks and the economists have weighed in on the rise of artificial intelligence, and we've talked about the implications for innovation and growth and labor and wages, but there are all these psychological effects that we should be thinking more about. Like, how does the Walmart cashier feel about the prospect of automation? Does this person feel now that they're replaceable? And what does that do to their own sense of humanity? What does that do to how they feel about other people who might want to take their jobs? And so that's what I'm exploring in a lot of my research and in the book as well.
The title of the book, again, listeners, The Power of Human by Adam Waitz. I want to touch on one other thing before we run out of time here, Adam, and that's the power of human touch. And you talk about that a great deal in your book, do you not?
Yes. It turns out that human touch is almost magical in many ways. So I talk about how there's a variety of studies showing that just holding another person's hand or touching another person's hand can do remarkable things. So there are studies showing that when people experience pain, so you go into the laboratory and you're administered some painful electric shock or heat, if you're holding a close other's hand, a spouse or partner, the pain actually feels less than if you were holding a stranger's hand or holding no hand at all. There's studies of basketball teams showing that basketball teams that touch each other more, that pat each other on the back more, actually play better and more cooperatively. And there's studies showing that knowing that an object was made by a human, a handmade object versus a machine-made object, makes people willing to pay more for that object. So these are a variety of ways that sort of the power of human touch can sort of transform objects and experiences and give them more meaning.
Have you gone the way of Alexa or Echo or any of those devices yet, Adam Waits?
Yes, unfortunately, I can't avoid them. You know, the convenience is too much, but I worry that at some point the costs are going to outweigh the benefits of convenience, and I'll be stuck talking to robots rather than human beings.
Well, it's a strange world that we're entering, that's for sure. And by the way, I agree with you
that's
on
right.
the power of human touch, and I rue the day when we continue to lose more and more of that. Folks, if you're looking for Adam Waits online, his last name is spelled W-A-Y-T-Z, and his book is The Power of Human. Adam, nice to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give your family the comfort and reliability you want, and lower your energy bills with the fuel that can do it all, propane. People across America trust propane to power everything that transforms a house into a home. Premium performance and lower energy bills. Propane can do that.
Brought to you by the Pennsylvania Propane Foundation and your local propane service provider.
We do all we can to ensure our kids are happy, healthy, safe, and strong. Having high-quality, low-cost health insurance makes that possible. With CHIP, your child can have medical, dental, eye care, and more for free or low cost. Whether you're self-employed, unemployed, or your employer benefits are just too expensive, CHIP is there for you to help your child be strong. CHIP strong. Apply or renew today at 800-986-KIDS or go to chipcoverspakids.com. Paid for with Pennsylvania taxpayer dollars.
It's a patriotic celebration of music with the Musicians Concert Band. Hi, this is Jimmy Chiprian, along with conductor-director Jeff Croner, as the band honors America with the Flags of Freedom March, Yankee Doodle, Armed Forces Salute, and of course, the Stars and Stripes Forever. The concert takes place Thursday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Butler Intermediate High School. That's Thursday, June 27th, 7 p.m., Butler Intermediate. See you there.
For kids, Idlewild is a place full of adventures. There are rides that are just their size, treats to tickle their taste buds, and special friends like Daniel Tiger to touch their hearts. When you're a grown-up, Idlewild is every bit as magical, every bit as memorable, every bit as fun. Idlewild and Soak Zone, because you love to see them smile. Save up to $17 on select days when you buy online at idlewild.com.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
We're up to 87 degrees outside right now. We're looking for some showers and thunderstorms this evening and into tonight. The high today was only supposed to get up to 85. We're already up to 87. Tonight, we're going to have a low around 64. Mostly sunny for Friday, scattered showers and thunderstorms, and a high near 86. And just a reminder that Central Electric Cooperative has asked everyone to conserve power by turning off all non-essential electric items. Set your air conditioner at a minimum of 78 degrees. Shift the use of items such as dehumidifiers, pool pumps, and electric appliances to hours outside of the peak period. This peak alert announcement from Central Electric Cooperative is going on from 1 until 7 today. Current temperature, 87. It's a summer day. Don't forget Pirate Baseball coming up for you starting at 1:45 this afternoon.
Don't you know that I dance, I dance to the four and the three, oh, and the head. the mirror of my mind. Time after time, I see reflections of you and me. Reflections of the way life used to be. Reflections of me.